The Author Meets the Critics. Welcome to The Author Meets the Critics, the original program which pits a best-selling author against two expert critics in a literary free-for-all. Now meet the man who keeps the peace on this program, your regular chairman, John K.M. McCaffrey.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. The American Legion has established a beachhead in New York City, so that we thought it most appropriate to devote this Sunday program to a leading figure of World Wars I and II, General Douglas MacArthur. Some of the Legionnaires look to General MacArthur as a great hero, a great leader, and in some smoke-filled rooms there is even talk of MacArthur for president. Two foreign correspondents who served in Japan at General MacArthur's supreme headquarters in Tokyo, Frank Kelly and Cornelius Ryan, are the authors of a new book entitled Star-Spangled Mikado. One need hardly add that Mr. Kelly and Mr. Ryan are referring to the same General MacArthur. Now, any book about MacArthur is bound to stir up an argument, and that's precisely what we're looking forward to this afternoon. Now, here are a few quotes from Star-Spangled Mikado that will give you an idea of the author's points of view. For example, Kelly and Ryan write this.
Americans, much as they may admire MacArthur for his undoubted military ability, don't really know the man. He's been out of the country too long, for one thing. For another, they're just a little suspicious about him because of those purple, fulsome communiques he used to issue during the war. Communiques that relegated the Navy and Air Force to second place. Communiques that always seemed to enlarge on the importance of some spit of an island in the grand scheme of things. Communiques that did not tell of the hardship, the heartbreak, and the mistakes of war.
That's a quote from page 26. Here's another from page 186.
Thank you for helping me attain my goal of seeing that General MacArthur got credit for everything in the Pacific and making sure that he was appointed Supreme Commander. So to his GI staff in Tokyo said Brigadier General Diller, one of the little clique who had been with the new Mikado since the dark days of 1940, 41, 42.
And one final statement on another controversial theme.
One may fairly ask, if the Japanese are to be our allies, for what purpose and against whom? Obviously the Russians, unless we intend to take on the Chinese or the British or the Filipinos in the Orient. Such talk is extremely loose and extremely dangerous. Japan is essentially a problem for the United Nations to handle. Those who would seize a United Nations problem, such as Japan, and subvert it to their own purposes or ideas are, in our opinion, failing in their duty. They are failing as tutors of the Japanese and in their obligations to the United Nations.
Star-Spangled Mikado, as these quotes demonstrate, is the kind of book that should stir up a controversy. And so we turn to our critics of the afternoon. We are hip deep in critics as well as in authors this afternoon. We have three critics, just for the Legion. First, a witness of the Japanese war trials, an ex-foreign correspondent, author and lecturer, an old friend of this program, Mr. John Getty.
This book really makes me angry. Here is the first book on the Japanese occupation, which to my mind is America's greatest endeavor in history, modern history. And it seemed to me a pity that Star-Spangled Mikado is flippantly journalistic. The constant sniping at a man of MacArthur's stature is unworthy. I'll have much more to say later, but you can mark me down as definitely against this book.
I don't think it was a coincidence, John, that Mr. Ryan was fingering his nose during your entire statement. Now, our next critic is Mr. Stuart Lillico, who lived in Japan for 5 years before the war, was a member of the staff on General MacArthur's headquarters, and whose new book is to be entitled The Battle for Japan. Mr. Lillico, what do you think of Star-Spangled Mikado?
The book is good in some spots and weak in others. The stories about MacArthur and the men around him are spicy and to the point. But the authors make a lot of statements about the Japanese, both as individuals and as a nation, that are hard to take.
Thank you, Mr. Lillico. Now, here's another point of view. Let's hear now from the other side, Mr. Robert Cochran of the Baltimore Sun, former Sun correspondent in Japan, not rising Sun correspondent, I might say here, who with the authors watched MacArthur from a newspaper man's point of view. Mr. Cochran, do you agree with Mr. Lillico?
Only to the extent that he likes the book in some respects. I like Star-Spangled Mikado because I have a newspaper man's high regard for fine reporting and for trenchant, effective writing. And Star-Spangled Mikado is both good writing and good reporting. This book calls serious attention for the first time to a mess of muddy footprints in the halls of the redoubtable legend of MacArthur the Superman and to the feet of clay that made them. I think Star Spangled Mikado is good fun and contains information important to the American people.
Now, Mr. Getty, I presume that you're going to concentrate on making Mr. Cochran a representative of the sinking sun. Would you like to carry that on a little further?
Well, yes. I feel annoyed that the group of correspondents that this book represents and Mr. Cochran is mentioned in it and there are two or three others as compared to a greater mass of correspondents who these people call sycophants if they side with MacArthur, and not only MacArthur, but the American job. MacArthur's merely one man there, and there are many other Americans, and I don't like the idea that MacArthur and the Americans around him are doing a bad job, they don't know what it's all about, and a few of these correspondents do. I don't like the flippant sniping that you get at MacArthur all the time, calling him the big man, the second divinity, the new son of heaven, and the title of Star-Spangled Mikado. I don't think that's worthy of an American of MacArthur's position.
All right, there you are, Mr. Cochran.
Well, he seems to be asking the question of what we think the job MacArthur doing in Japan amounts to, and I would say it's vastly overrated. For example, most of the reforms that he has been given credit for in Japan were generated in Washington and in top-line communiques and instructions that he received. He was simply carrying out instructions. Others, for which he gets credit, were developed by the people under him, and still others were developed by observers who were either on the scene or in other parts of the world.
Well, now, this puts you in opposition even to our authors. Despite the fact that they snipe and are very flippant about MacArthur, generally speaking, in the book, they flatly say they think he's done a good job. So now we have at least three points of view represented here. Is that right, Mr. Cochran?
Well, they say he's done a good job in some respects, and in some respects, I presume he has. In other words, he has put a definite authority over most of the occupation, and when he tells somebody to do some one thing, well, that one thing is done with speed and dispatch. But there's some other things that he has tried to do and which haven't been so successful. I think, for example, the most spectacular failure of the MacArthur administration in Japan has been the economic debacle, because it's demonstrable that perhaps they haven't brought Japan low, but they have not done anything much to rescue Japan from the economic ruin which is there present at this time. All they have done is to saddle the United States with a very expensive and very intricate problem of feeding a nation and renovating its industries. And they aren't getting along very well with that. All it's doing is costing the American taxpayer from half to three-quarters of $1 billion a year. And I think it's time the American taxpayer knew that that money was going out for that, and that he knew why.
Mr. Getty, well, as a taxpayer, would you put on your barrel and make a comment on that?
Well, I'd like to comment this. That was just my plea about the book, that instead of tackling this very serious, very vital, very important American problem that involves us all, as Mr. Cochran has just done, this first book, again, I repeat, went along too flippantly. In other words, the American reader wasn't given his money's worth in this book. And I don't think the picture painted is correct. That's my feeling about it.
Now, Mr. Lillico, I don't think we're getting our money out of you. What about some of the reservations that you have on this book?
My main objection to the book was that while the picture of MacArthur and the men around him was interesting and accurate, no doubt, it failed to show what the Japanese people themselves were doing in this occupation. It is a terrific problem. Just what the Japanese are going to do, what they have been doing since the surrender. And the book, as far as I could tell, didn't ever really give us any real information on that.
Well, I'm going to come in here temporarily on Mr. Getty's side and ask a couple of questions of Mr. Cochran. Throughout this entire book, whenever they make a flat statement, our authors, Mr. Ryan and Mr. Kelly, they say, yes, MacArthur has done a good job, and they speak of him as a very fine administrator and so forth. But every story, every incident in the book which shows MacArthur in action tends to derogate him, tends to pull him down, tends to be a little snide. How do you feel about such a statement, Mr. Cochran?
I think those are evidences of just the thing I was talking about. For example, most of the stories you read in the newspapers nowadays and for a long time past have tended to elevate him, and I think these authors probably feel, as I do, that now is the time to start hearing the other side of the story. There are a great many factors entering the problem just at this time, the problem of peace, the problem of a new presidential election coming up, and I think they probably feel that those stories are very necessary.
Well, I'm interested in the story about the presidential election because they've got one in, and they presented a whole page of this story in the book as an apocryphal story, and I think that perhaps it's time to bring our authors of the day on and have Mr. Ryan and Mr. Kelly comment on this particular story involving Mr. Dewey and General MacArthur and the presidential campaign and this apocrypha that we've commented on. Mr. Ryan.
Well, I think before I start on this, I think I should tell you a little story. You see, we have two critics here this afternoon. Well, I expect Mr. Geddes to be angry because he generally is. Mr. Geddes likes being angry. He's angry at everything. As for Mr. Lillico, he hasn't quite made up his mind whether to be angry or not. So I think we'll leave him out just for the moment. But you two gentlemen remind me very much of the man who had an eel, a pet eel. And he kept it in a tank out in the garden, you see. So one day he went out and had a look at the eel swimming around. And he said to my, but you look very, very lonely indeed. And he said to the eel, this little electric eel, he said, what's wrong with you? The eel said, well, really, what the matter is, I want another eel in here to play with, you see. After all, I'm a male, and it'd be nice if I had a sort of a female eel in here, too. So the man said, well, I'll get you another eel. So he, a couple of days later, he brought him in, another eel. So the two little electric eels swam around the tank. A couple of days later, man went out and had a look at the eels, but they were both very unhappy. And he said, what's wrong? Well, said the first eel, I'm DC, and the other fellow was AC. Now, Mr. Geddes is DC. In other words, he's direct. Mr. Lillico slightly alternates. As far as this book is concerned, certain things have been said about it, and you've asked me about the presidential, the little thing we have in here about General MacArthur's ambitions, and so forth, and I'd like to read this page. The general, back in 1946, was particularly interested in the election of 1948, and invited a certain friend into headquarters one day, and they sat down and they talked about it. And I'll just read this page. The general and his friend looked to the Republican horses and jotted down the figures. The figures were the lineup of delegates to the 1948 Republican convention. From so many angles, it looked like a stalemate between Taft and Dewey. The scene now shifts to Albany, New York. The light is not so clear. The dialogue is probably apocryphal. The tagline is hilarious, but MacArthur's confidence is there, and he's paying a social call on Governor Dewey. I hope Governor Dewey is listening in to this.
I'm sure that he is, Mr. Ryan.
Says the confidant. Looks close for 48, doesn't it, Tom? Yes, says Dewey. Could be a stalemate between you and Taft, couldn't it, Tom? Don't know. Could be, says Dewey. Not even thinking about it. Suppose it were, Tom, says the confidant. What would you do? Why, says Tom, in that case, I'd go to the convention floor and nominate General MacArthur, and I'd sweep the house with him.
Well, now then, by your own definition, the dialogue is probably apocryphal. Now, I'm just wondering, as perhaps Mr. Getty is, what kind of reporting is this? Mr. Kelly.
I'd like to handle that one, if I may, Mr. McCaffrey. I happen to have talked to the man who is identified here as the confidant. I could not reproduce his exact words from memory, and since there was nothing about it that was off the record, I did not feel at liberty to conceal it forever.
But you did feel it necessary to conceal the name of the man who told it to you, which is the only source or authority or documenting or footnoting that you have for it.
I did, because the man still is connected in very high places and might be very embarrassing to him.
Well, that's the whole thing all the way through. There's so many incidents like that. Referring to the eel story that Mr. Ryan just told, they tell an alleged joke on General Eisenhower, then Colonel Eisenhower, who was returning from the Philippines after service with MacArthur. And I think as it goes, he was asked, did he learn anything in the Philippines? And he very coyly says, yes, I learned a lot about dramatics. Well, no, I don't think Ike Eisenhower would back that up in regard to MacArthur.
I'm afraid, gentlemen, that we're getting into another program called Can You Top This? Perhaps we should just go on with the discussion of this book. I think that there are a couple of questions that should be asked, and with all this weight of brains on the table around from me, somebody should be able to answer them. Now, does this book tell us anything about what we should do with Japan? Mr. Cochran.
Oh, I think it tells us a great many things that are possible and things that are would probably be the intelligent thing. The main conclusion of the book is that we should hand Japan over to the United Nations because, as they say, this nation, this defeated nation with its conquerors on its own soil, regulating its entire life, its political life, its educational life, its religious life, its economic life, that should be handed over to the United Nations.
Well, now, Mr. Getty, what about that?
Well, of course, that's what General MacArthur has suggested himself. That's no different from his policy. Well, but on the other hand, they charge MacArthur with needlessly needling the Russians. And then, after saying that, they go on to give two or three pages of where the Russians are a pest and a nuisance out there and a danger to us. But then toward the end, they issue this little quaint bit. They say, we must beware of certain Japanese playing upon our foibles and phobias, such as communism. Well, now, anybody who realistically sees the situation in the Far East today, in Korea and China and possibly in Japan itself, certainly knows that our fears about communism are not foibles and phobias.
How are your foibles right now, Mr. Ryan?
Well, of course, Mr. Getty is one of these people who jumps on the bandwagon to suit himself. I think I made it quite clear last week, speaking on another program, where Mr. Getty was also opposing us, that I took a rather dim view of his own book. You see, back in 1940, Mr. Getty jumped on the Japanese bandwagon. And at that time, the Japanese were rather nice people. Now, Mr. Getty, it's convenient for you to jump on the MacArthur bandwagon.
May
really,
I just
you know?
Point out that that book was written in 1943 after I'd been a prisoner of the Japanese for 7 months and was repatriated. Had nothing to do with the Japanese bandwagon.
You consider this an Aesop's foible?
Absolutely. Worse than that.
I'll stand up for Mr. Getty on his book, though. I thought it was an excellent book.
Well, I've been tried. But
I would like to
here
find
again,
out.
Let's have a joke. Mr. Ryan overlooks the Japanese saying that the one who first loses his temper shows that he's the first one to run out of arguments. So let's have some arguments instead of temper.
Well, what are these things that we should do with Japan, gentlemen? Mr. Lillico, can you give us any of the suggestions that either, since you are alternating, you've given us some bad things here. What about the things you like? Do they tell us what we should do with
Japan?
They
tell us what we should do. I don't know that I agree that we should do what they say. I think myself that the American occupation of Japan, I say American because although the British are in there, the Americans are running the occupation. I feel that American occupation is a generally good occupation and is traveling in the right direction. I'm not so sure that a United Nations occupation or even control, if the military forces were removed, would be anywhere near so effective and good for the Japanese themselves in the long run.
Well, I think that's an opinion that our authors will have to defend then. Mr. Kelly.
Don't you think, Mr. Lillico, that if we do turn it over or at least give the UN a chance to operate in the Japanese situation, that we can avoid some of the interminable wrangling that we get in the Big Four discussions, which, so far as I can determine, completely cut out the voices of so many other nations and smaller powers?
Well, I feel that the Japan situation is far too important for us to use as an experiment on the United Nations. If the
But that justifies the Russian point of view, the Bulgaria, Hungary, Austria, or any other place is too important a place for them to justify any experimenting on their part. Which, in the long run, then, we have a United Nations, which is just an organization and doesn't do anything. Mr. Ryan.
Well,
Mr. Ryan, the histrionics over here, the look of profound disgust on his face is something that should be televised.
I get profoundly disgust when I hear certain people talk. However, there are certain things about this whole business. I think we said that we would like to see the United Nations take over Japan. We really would, because we don't think that everything the general is doing out there is as good as it's cracked up to be. We just don't think so. We don't think that the public are really being told. As a matter of fact, we hear a lot of talk about an iron curtain, but in Japan, there's a, shall we say, a MacArthur's mesh curtain hanging around. The people, I don't think America's really being told. I think just as we wrote that the directives are fulsome and large and magnificent, and they paint MacArthur's being a very great man, but did they really tell us what it is like out there? Do they really tell us today what is going on there?
I don't think we do.
We have the World Press out there, the three wire services, Mr. Kelly's paper, the New York Times, and all those papers.
I beg your pardon, the
New York Herald
that
Tribune.
That was the cruelest thing you've done so far.
You've really slayed me with that one.
I can't believe that Mr. Ryan thinks for a moment those men aren't doing their good job, although he does criticize most of them as being sycophants because they do play the game with the American occupation.
Well, don't you think that's a matter, too, of which paper you read? Now, if you read the reports of Gordon Walker in the Christian Science Monitor and Ralph Chapman in the Herald Tribune, they don't always agree with the Associated Press reports, which are largely concerned with headquarters handling.
Well, take a man like Mr. A.T. Steele, who's just had 7 articles in the New York Herald Tribune. And certainly he didn't stand with the ones who are...
Well, I'm not going to allow you people to sit around here and scratch the backs of your friends. You're paying off all social debts, I can tell. Well, I'm going to come back to Mr. Ryan, who, despite his disgust, he has left the sick bed to attend this broadcast, and we're very grateful for that. But I'm going to come back and ask you, Mr. Ryan, for whom were you covering what at the time that you wrote this book? You're now with Time Magazine, I believe.
Well, at that time, I was with the London Daily Telegraph, and for a time, I covered out there also for Time Magazine. Now, what I objected to out there is just this. We got communiques all set up, all ready to go. The agencies, and Mr. Gettys will surely know what I'm talking about. He was once an INS correspondent. The agencies grabbed the communiques and off they went. It looked as if when General MacArthur decided to do something, it looked as if it went into action immediately, that radio messages flashed to every little village, every little town. The governors of all these prefectures in Japan promptly took it. They understood English. They read the directive, and everything was set into working order immediately.
Probably set by means of electric eels.
Probably. Well, now, here's what I found. I remember one time going down to... the prefecture that was under the command of the 6th Army, General Kruger. And I went to one governor of a Japanese province, and I walked into his office, and the unfortunate little man, he didn't speak English, but on his desk there was a very large pile of directives. And I looked at these directives, and I fingered them right down along, and I found that they went back 7 months. So through my interpreter, I asked the governor, what was happening to the directives. And he was very apologetic. He said, you know, I would put all these things into effect, and I think everything is, we love the Americans and so forth, but I can't understand English. Now, that was just one little thing.
Poor story.
I'd like to bring in that the remarks you make that 85% of the Japanese people cannot intelligently read a newspaper. Well, now, MacArthur's last report shows there's some 250 newspapers published there now, 3 of them with a circulation over 1 million, and the magazines running into 100, some of them with a circulation of 1 million. Now, if they can't read, why do the publishers publish that many magazines and
newspapers? Well, the winds are cold, I suppose, but Mr. Kelly.
I'd like to amplify that because you've raised an interesting point. The figure of 85% developed inside headquarters itself, which had various surveys made for the purpose of controlling and censoring and revamping the Japanese press. 85% of the Japanese, it's probably dropped by this time, say 80%, perhaps 75%, cannot read the whole paper and understand every word, every ideogram.
Your book said it, read it intelligently, as I phrased it. I think that's the way it was put.
Yeah, yes. They cannot, they cannot, without benefit of the side writing, as you know it, understand the context, the purport of the main article.
Well, I bring this up in connection with the statement that the directives are a lot of piles on people's desks. Now, the newspapers are an important organ in the progress of our administration and what we want to do with it.
I think they
can do a better job than you point out.
And yet this matter of the propagation of the directives and the sending them out into the hinterlands of Japan was so serious that in January 46 it caused an investigation in GHQ itself. And a large amount of reorganization was done in some effort to try to get a wider response to the orders from Tokyo.
Well, now, just a minute. I'd like to point out that Mr. Kelly and Mr. Ryan themselves in the book state that one of the terrible handicaps of the occupation of Japan is the language difficulty, that there were only 3,000 people among all of the occupation people, civilian and military, who could handle Japanese. Well, I don't think that you can blame General MacArthur for the fact that Japanese is...
not the sort of thing we use to ask for a beer. I mean, after all, there are very few people who know Japanese. Mr. Ryan?
Well, you see, when we landed there, there were very few people who spoke Japanese among our forces. I think we give a figure of 3,000, isn't that right?
That's right.
In Germany, for example, we went in there all prepared. We knew the country and everything else. Well, in Japan, it was pathetic for the first 2 or 3 months. It really was, because everywhere you went, you found that we'd been caught with our pants really down. I mean, we really had. The whole thing had collapsed so suddenly. Now, one would have thought, though, that, say, 8 or 9 months later, that the whole matter would have improved. Instead of that, I remember, just before I left Japan, finding that the situation was just as bad, I found officers out in remote parts of the country who were trying to do their best. They, in some place, they had no interpreters. It was really pathetic. Now, you had some of the upper-class Japanese who spoke English. Would you, for example, Mr. Getty, facing yourself in the position of one of those officers there, would you like to have one of the old-school kimono Japanese, shall we say, acting as your interpreter? But that's what was happening in some parts of Japan. They were actually using Japanese officials as interpreters. Now, surely, anything could have happened under those circumstances.
Yes, but as Mr. McCaffrey said, that isn't the Americans on the spot or MacArthur. That was just what we didn't have. And that's my feeling about it. Instead of setting the correspondents up as super critics of this, if we look at it as an American job, regardless of MacArthur, MacArthur's one man out there and we've got the army, it's an American job, we have to do it. And I think it has to be more soberly appraised than was done in your book.
Well, you can't look at the Japanese occupation regardless of MacArthur, because every piece of paper that comes out of headquarters has by order of General MacArthur on it, and the people who presume to put their own names in those places don't last very long in Japan.
Well, I would tend once again to find myself on Mr. Getty's side on the terms of the correspondence. I tend to find a note creeping into the book, Mr. Ryan and Mr. Kelly. I can remember even a phrase where you were commenting on how bad it was to come into Japan and live there, and you said even the correspondents had very bad housing, as if, well, mercy. If the correspondents are going to have bad housing, what is going to happen next? How do you feel about that?
Worse than that, Mr. McCaffrey, the bar in the American Correspondents Club was closed down for 5 whole minutes at one time. Well, I'm quoting the book.
The fire is a fire,
though. McCaffrey and Mr. Getty and Mr. Lillico, some of us who were out there came along with the troops the hard way, and we landed with them on the beaches, and we dug our own foxholes and so forth. We're not particularly proud of that. It was what one did. We shared what came along, and we thought, I think, that we were entitled to a few creature comforts.
Comforts for creatures? you wouldn't even care to put it there. Mr. Ryan, do you have any comment on the closing of the bar?
I think that one gets a bit mad, you know, when you get the head of the public relations department saying to you, well, you know, the only reason we are really allowing you people to stay here is, well, you know, you send news out of here, and we have to have you here, but otherwise we wouldn't have you. And
I'm sorry.
That's the thing that we got.
Time's up, gentlemen, for both the authors and the critics, all 15 of them. And now, here is your announcer to tell you what lies ahead on next week's Author Meets the Critics program.
Confidant and supporter of Mayor James J. Walker and President Franklin Delano Roosevelt, Democratic leader of New York's Bronx County for 25 years, where he has never lost a local election. Chairman of the Democratic National Committee from 1940 to 1943. Trusted emissary on secret international missions. He has been investigated and he has been attacked. He is Edward J. Flynn, one of the leading political figures in America. Next week, the author meets the critics will discuss Edward J. Flynn's new book, You're the Boss. And now back to Mr. McCaffrey.
Before closing, I'd like to thank Frank Kelly and Cornelius Ryan for coming here to discuss with the maximum of malice Star Spangled Mikado, and thank you, Stuart Lillico and Robert Cochran, for joining us. Be sure to listen next week for what should be one of the most exciting programs in many weeks, Edward J. Flynn's You're the Boss. This is John K. M. McCaffrey, and I'm also thanking you, Mr. Cochran. Did I get you in? I got Mr. Lillico, Mr. Cochran, but I didn't get in Mr. Getty. Thank you, Mr. Getty, for creating a lot of dissension and gore. This is John McCaffrey saying good afternoon for The Author Meets the Critic.
This is NBC, the National Broadcasting Company.